Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Formula One Grid Talk. This is episode 188. My name is Tom Horrocks, and today on F1 Firesides, we have with us a newcomer to the podcast, Gregor Grant. Hello, Gregor. Welcome to the show. And would you like to explain to our audience what is your field of expertise and your experience in motorsport while you're here today?
Well, thanks, Tom. Good to be here. I've got a rather boring background compared to yours, but I'm a lawyer. I don't know whether you've had a lawyer on before, but I work for a firm of patent attorneys who have a sort of integrated law firm called Marks and Clark. They're quite large, and they've got clients in the automotive industry and have had, you know, for many, many years. I mean, just as an aside, before I start on anything else, Clark, Sir Dugald Clark, one of the founders in the late 19th century, invented the two-stroke engine.
Brilliant.
Within the space of 10 years, in the 1880s or so, there were three sorts of internal combustion engine invented. One was the four-stroke by Ludwig Otto, the Otto cycle. The other, the diesel engine, I think it was Rudolf Diesel, Germany. And the other was Dougal Clark, who invented the two-stroke, which, you know, I don't think he made huge amounts of money out of it, but I mean, until not that long ago, virtually every small motorcycle and certainly every chainsaw had a noisy, smelly, smoky two-stroke engine. It was all down to Dougal Clark. His partner, Marks, became Lord Marks. He was quite a big wheel, sort of big Victorian stroke, Edwardian wheel back in that time. They're long gone, but they founded this firm, and it's quite a large firm of patent attorneys with offices all over the shop. So I joined them as a lawyer. So I deal with largely with litigation. Right? We might come on to a couple of litigation issues in i.e. suing people for infringing rights and so on. Mm-hmm. But the firm as a whole is very technically based and very involved in automotive industry and so on and so forth. So that's my professional day-to-day life. In terms of motor racing, I haven't done much in professionally, but I don't know if you're interested in my sort of background.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm very interested in getting into your background.
Okay, well, I mean, basically, I was brought up with motor racing. I mean, I never actually raced. I never had any talent or any money to be a sort of motor racer. Largely through my dad, who has the same name as me, or had the same name as me, who started Autosport, which is still in existence, obviously.
Yeah.
So in the 50s and 60s, he was, he was kind of the almost like the premier sort of British journalist in the field. So he knew everybody, and everyone knew him. He did a bit of racing and so on and so forth. So we as a family were heavily involved in motor races. I used to go to motor races with him and my other siblings and so on, pretty well every weekend, you know, Silverstone, Alton Park, you name it, plus abroad. And later on, when I, in my 20s, I wrote for the magazine and so on, just sort of articles about races and so on. So very much plugged in at that time. But then he died and the thing was sold. So I haven't really been involved actively, except as a very keen spectator of motor racing. My mother was involved as well, because she helped us start a thing called the Doghouse Owners Club. I don't know, have you heard of that, Tom?
No.
Yeah, well, it was started when all the drivers' wives, we're talking about sort of Betty Hill, Betty Brabham, yes, Adam McLaren, that era, okay? We're all sitting around in windswept airfield circuits, bored, rigid, and while their husbands were out, you know, potentially injuring themselves. And so they clubbed together, called the Doghouse Owners Club, which became quite well known. And I'm told someone's actually making a film about it. Yeah, it's on a documentary. Apparently, so someone's going to be playing my mum. I don't know who. I don't think it's Nicole Kidman, but I don't know who. But we're all involved. My sister did Stirling Moss's scrapbook and then Graham Hill's scrapbook. My brother designed the logo for the Hesketh, you know, James Hunt's Hesketh in the film with Niki Lauda, right, which was a sort of teddy bear with a crash hat on, right, and did some other design work for other teams and so on. So in a nutshell, I hope it's, I haven't gone on too long, my involvement as a younger person in motor racing was almost complete. I mean, I had very few other interests in life, actually. But now I've got to earn a living and so on and so forth. So that's that.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, that's. I cannot wait to get into some of that. There's some really fun stuff in there. Motorsport literally running through your veins. And yes, the Doghouse Owners Club, I remember that was mentioned, I believe, in, it was Damon Hill's brilliant book, actually.
It was mentioned.
That's where I've heard of it. So yeah, I forgot the name, but that is where I've heard of it. But before we get into this, I'd just like to talk before we get into the hugely exciting world of intellectual property laws. I'd like to remind everyone that we do live previews and reviews for every race weekend, which go out live on YouTube and on all major audio platforms too. Just search for F1 Chronicle and go to f1chronicle.com to find out more. If you subscribe and click the bell on YouTube, then you'll know when we're live. So please consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify if you think we deserve it. So I don't know where to start really with this. I think maybe if we start with some of your personal stories through motorsport, and then we'll move on to, I know you want to speak about innovation in motorsport and some of the things that we think Formula One could potentially do better. So we'll move on to that a little bit later on. But I'd love to hear a little bit more some of your stories from the past in with regards to sort of your time around Formula One and some of the characters that you came into. So I understand you've met Jimmy Clark a few times. You're good friends with Graham Hill. Yeah, where to start really?
Graham Hill was a sort of family friend because I live in North London. He was from there. He used to work down the road to start his life as a mechanic at a speed shop called Speedwell. That's how he kicked off. And so he was regularly around. And of course, his wife Betty and my mother were quite good pals, and Damon and his two sisters. You know, they were just sort of family pals. We went to parties and that sort of stuff. Jimmy Clark, no, I just met him at races. My dad knew him quite well because I'm Scottish and my dad was very Scottish. And so he and Jimmy were quite good pals. But I met him a couple of times, incredibly quiet. I do remember his fingernails. They were so bitten, you could hardly see them. And you know, you wouldn't have thought. And he was extraordinary. He won, I don't know, was it 25-30% of all the races he competed in, he won. I don't know, I was thinking about a few things. I mean, I think the last time I saw Graham Hill race was at Monaco I can't remember the date now, it was 79. Anyway, I went down with some friends. I think my dad was either ill or had passed away by that point. One of them had this rather decrepit Piper Comanche, I think it was six-seater high wing. We all went down, one engine, took us ages. It only did about 100 miles an hour at 5. We got there, but what struck me thinking about this was the difference between then and now in motor racing and how casual, right, it was then compared to now. I mean, it's serious, but now it's a real massive, you know, undertaking, commercial. And I know what one can be a bit boring about, you know, back in the old days, it was different. But just something occurred to me as I was thinking about this. So I go to Monaco, and I wasn't attached to any newspaper. I didn't have anything on. My friend, Curly Manning, now deceased, great fun, he some years before, he started writing to all the race organisers asking for tickets from a thing called Needle Press in Peterborough, okay? And he got tickets and photographer's tickets and all sorts of for Le Mans, Monaco, et cetera, et cetera. So he was obviously on their mailing list, so he was okay, right? The thing is, Needle Press basically made greetings cards, right?
Right.
They had nothing to do with motor racing at all. It was just a sort of, so he got these tickets. So I had a photographer's pass for the Monaco Grand Prix. So I was there for a while. And I was with, actually, the autosport photographer. And I carried his aluminium, you know, the big case that photographers have, you know, with, that looks important.
Yeah.
It was actually empty, but I had to look as though it was full of stuff that I was helping. I think all there was in there was a packet of fags or something. You know? But what I do remember is walking up after Saint-Devot, that's the right-hander after the straight, okay, up to Casino Square, walking up on the right-hand side, I don't think there was a barrier. There might have been. If there was, it was very small. With Phil, my friend, and cars going past at 150, I don't know whatever they were, including Graham Hill, who won the race, going past and giving us a V sign, you know. We could just do that, you know. And I had this fake photographer's, well, it's a real photographer's pass, but for a fake organisation. Mm. And that kind of thing was very much part of the deal.
I can't imagine that happening, and certainly in Bernie's era. And he's very
kind of... It all got very strict and difficult, and you couldn't get into things, you know. But it was just fair enough, because it was it's a much bigger thing now than it was. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a lovely story. Brilliant story. That's really is a lovely story. And I imagine just the way the paddock was is completely different to how it is now. And especially from a safety point of view, I mean, you look at it now on TV and you see how things are on TV. How different is it to how it was back then?
Well, I mean, walking up the hill at Sandy Bot, ho, 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 you know, that sort of thing. Well, of course, there's the safety of the cars and the safety of the spectators and drivers, you know, in the context of barriers and so on. Cars, well, I mean, everyone knows this. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, I mean, my dad was every few weeks would pop off to some funeral, you know, in mm-hmm. Sweden or Milan, right? Some 23-year-old driver died in a flaming wreck, you know, and that was quite common, you know, and that inspired Jackie Stewart and I think Niki Lauda later on to sort of start getting vociferous about fuel safety, you know, fuel tanks that didn't rupture and blah, blah, you know, and of course Lauda himself had some pretty good reason for doing that. But it took a while, and Armco barriers came in, you know, having had either nothing or straw bales, and safety has definitely improve. And it's terribly important. I mean, I think, you know, these cars go jolly, jolly fast. That's the whole point. I think it does have, there is a sort of cusp between safety and innovation, because requirements, which are largely a lot to do with safety, do prevent innovation. You can't go and do what you want to do, basically. You've got to have a regard to safety, and the rules, the regulations are framed very much to make the cars safer, and it really is chalk and cheese. You kind of create. I mean, look at Grosjean's accident last year.
Oh yeah.
I mean, come on. I mean, if that had happened a few years ago, we wouldn't have a Grosjean at all. You know, he wouldn't be off in Indianapolis. He'd be, you know, 6 feet under. I mean, things have improved immensely. It's no two ways about it. But you've got to do that in the context of a very dangerous spectacle. You know.
Yes.
It's a balancing act, isn't it?
It's inherently dangerous, just motorsport in general, obviously, and the safety side of things, it's massively important. It's quite chilling actually to think that the rules with regards to the overalls that they wear, they changed them going into that season where Grosjean had the accident, and to think that if he had had his accident 1 year earlier, the amount that the fire suits were supposed to be fireproofed were the same as his gloves the previous season, and you see the state of his hands, that would have been his entire body had he had that crash 1 year earlier, which is just chilling to think that's how close we came to losing Roman, and in a sport that has been saying for years how safe it is, and you know, apart from poor Gilles Bianchi, obviously, when we lost him after the accident.
It was a freak accident,
but yeah. Again, it's led to positive change. It led to the introduction to virtual safety car and much better innovations around the track itself. But do you find that I mean, obviously, we know the safety needs to be there. Do you find that it actually stifles some of the innovation, or does it actually improve the innovation because they have things to work around?
It's hard to say that it stifles innovation. I mean, I do find that a lot of the rules now, if we're going to talk about the rules, I mean, I'm not an expert on them, and I'm not even sure if you can get hold of a copy. Are they available to the...
Yeah, they are freely available online. You can download them.
All right. Okay, well, I gather there's quite a lot of it. I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I'm usually dealing with great piles of paper, but, you know, it does seem to be very prescriptive. You do this, you do that. And it really is quite amazing that cars, you know, although superficially look very similar, actually, in many ways, are actually quite different. So there is some scope. So innovation is stifled by requirements for dimensions, and you can't have this bigger than that, and blah, blah, blah. But nonetheless, within that context, they do jolly well. In fact, I don't even remember, at the beginning of this year, Ross Brawn, who, of course, was a great innovator and came up with the... things on the Brawn car, you know, was it the diffuser at the back, wasn't it?
Yes. Right.
Because now he's turned gamekeeper. It expressed some degree of surprise that there was so much difference between the new breed of Formula One cars, between one car and another, given the regulations. He wasn't expecting things that, you know, like the very narrow sort of side pods on the Mercedes. You know, they've got very small ducts, and they've been very clever with the airflow. And he was jolly impressed that they'd done that. So he'd set these very high bars of role. Of laws, and the teams have beavered away and managed to be quite innovative. Mind you, I don't think that's done Mercedes much good so far anyway.
Well, no, yes. It did make me laugh that there was people straight away ready to protest, and I was seeing articles saying that Lewis Hamilton will be cruising to his eighth world title with a car that's going to be 2 seconds a lap quicker than everyone. And then as soon as it hit the track, everyone was like, actually, yeah, they can have that.
Yeah, I think the protest sort of mindset, I'm not altogether happy with. I mean, I'm a lawyer, I suppose I should be happy with it, but it does kind of bring the legal framework into interpreting these rules. And of course, it's all done very privately. You don't really know. I mean, a couple of years ago, the Ferrari, you know, the fuel. I don't really know the ins and outs of that, but my understanding is that they had found some wizard wheeze with the fuel flow by having a sort of pulsed flow that interfered with the other. I don't know, jolly clever, which was or maybe was or was not within the rules, and they got take, you know, some. I don't even object to it. I imagine it was Red Bull. They seem to object to everything. Actually, better take that out.
No. <it's- laughs> It's to just say the word allegedly afterwards, you'll be fine.
But allegedly. there was something earlier this year when they allegedly objected that they denied that they had done about the mirrors on the Mercedes, I think.
Yes.
But anyway, but the Ferrari thing, actually, I found actually, particularly because the findings were not published, Ferrari had to change their engines. No one knows really why, and it's all kind of nods and winks and so on. And the result was the Ferrari slipped down right to the back of the grid, you know, which isn't good for business. So I, you know, Ferrari had worked out some wizard wheeze with a fuel delivery system in some way. You might know better than I do. And they got jumped on. And I think, as a member of the public, you think, well, come on, guys, you know, this is the pinnacle of motorsport. If they thought up some clever way of doing stuff, well, let them get on with it and let the other people try and, you know, do that. If it's that clever, they can work out the same thing themselves or improve it, you know. I think that there is a stifling. I don't really think that safety is what it's all about. I think I'm not very right-wing. I use the word nanny state. I probably sound a bit right wing, but I think there was a bit of sort of nanny about all this. It's just too much regulation.
Well, I think nothing was published, but the way I understand that the rumours about the Ferrari situation were, which I state for legal reasons, all rumours, we have no evidence to say the contrary, that what was happening was there is a set fuel flow that you're not allowed to exceed. And they found a way of pulsing that, like you say, between the intervals when it was measured. And that is in contravenance of the regulations. There's grey areas, there's exploiting loopholes, and then there's actually finding a way to circumvent the regulation by cheating. And that's more what the rumor was. So if it was the fact that it's, you know, that, oh, they found a workaround, like, you know, that the rule says that this can't, it doesn't say that specifically this can't be here, you know, for me personally, I'm all fine with that, because congratulations, you found a loophole that's, you know, you get to exploit that. But when they're actually, you know, claiming that the system is delivering X amount of fuel when actually it's delivering Y amount of fuel, that for me is a slightly different scenario. But
I take the point. I think there was a slight distinction. We are hamstrung by the fact that we don't know that.
But this, your point is completely valid. in that because we don't know, because there's no transparency, because we were never told, we're left to wildly speculate like we are now, and we just don't know, and that's the frustrating thing about it. But I suspect potentially the FIA were caught with their pants down a little bit on that one, and that it was too embarrassing for them to reveal what Ferrari had managed to do.
Yeah, I think so. But you might also ask yourself, why do we have that rule in the first place? You know, why all this fancy rule stuff about fuel?
Yeah.
Fuel. You know, if the engine is completely flooded with fuel, you've got to run out. You're going to run out of petrol before the end. You know, you've got to meet your own fuel. Why have they got to tell you how much fuel to meet it? I mean, I'm completely ignorant on this point, but it just seems to me, from the public point of view. The point of view of the spectacle. Suddenly Ferrari are taken out of the equation. The car that was fantastic is now hopeless. And this year they've got their own back a bit, I think.
Yeah, certainly is. They certainly started very well so far this year. And just for any listeners listening in, this episode will be airing after the Imola Grand Prix. Yeah. This episode is being recorded before we go to Imola. So it's just in case there's anything that's happened at Imola where Ferrari have been disqualified or anything like that we don't know about. Just as a caveat, we don't know about that yet. So anything you hear is based on what was known before the race at Imola this weekend for us. Yeah, so as you said, that is the problem really with the lack of transparency, that we just don't see what happens with these things, which is a bit of a shame from a fan perspective. But with this new regulation of cars that's come out, obviously we've seen a lot of benefits that have come from it already, but we're looking ahead to 2025, 2026, when we get these new engines, what would you like to see with regards to innovation and what you want to see from the formula, from those from that new regulation set that's coming?
Well, dear Bernie Eccleston, who's still around and got some things right, but quite a lot wrong, he was always banging on about the hybrid cars not being noisy enough, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's some truth in that because, okay, it doesn't matter so much on the TV, but if you actually go to a motor race back in the day, and one of those V10s or V12s, you know, whizzed past, I mean, it blew your hat off, and it actually, I remember taking my children once, and one of them was actually ill. It was a sound blast. Yeah. They're really jolly loud, you know. Mm. It's a bit more noise because the thing is a spectacle. I mean, all sport is a spectacle. Really. People pay to watch it because it's an entertainment. And I think just to take a step back to this year, when we've had the ground effect having been banned for so long, I think largely for safety reasons. I think at the time because cars basically didn't have to slow down going around corners. think of bucket of water on a string and the string breaks, that was the sort of thinking.
Yeah.
And you had flat bottoms. And so you had all this, it looks silly, all these wings and winglets and thingies and, canards and if you touch another car, bits of carbon fiber fly off all over the place, and they all look a bit daft. And so this year the cars look a lot cleaner. Right, yes. Largely because because of ground effect, there are these channels underneath the car that create a partial vacuum, and which seems to work in terms of following closely. I think that's the take home message. I think for the first few races that seems to be the case. Whether that's going to always be true, I don't know. But certainly, there's less turbulence behind the car, and therefore it's easier to follow. That to me is an innovation. That was sort of forced on them because racing was getting so boring because you came up behind another car and you couldn't get near it, because of all the turbulence. And I think that's a good thing that they've allowed teams to go to ground effect. The surprising thing this year is that the team who you kind of put at the top of the list of cleverness is Mercedes, seem to have got it wrong. I don't know why. I'm not sure they know why, but they obviously have a different design of the Venturi under the car. I think they'll get it right because they're quite clever up there in Brackley, is it?
Yes, Brackley and Brixworth over the two.
Brixworth, the engines. And I think, but looking ahead, Tom, I mean, I'm not quite sure when the new engine regs are coming in. They put it off for a bit, didn't they?
Yeah, I think it's 26, but I could be. I'm happy to be corrected.
Well, it's back to the noise point, the Bernie noise point. If he's alive, then perhaps he's. Perhaps he'll be happy.
That, Bernie's never leaving us. We know this.
If you do away with the MTUH, I think people are thinking that that's one of the contributors to the sound not being as in your face as it was. I don't think that the kinetic recovery is a factor in it. I'm not familiar with the technicals on that, but I think if they're louder, that'd be nicer. Yeah.
Yes, I've never attended a Grand Prix event with a V10 engine, but I remember attending I think it was the 2007 Silverstone Grand Prix was my first race I attended live, and I remember standing on hangar straight as the cars were going past, desperately trying to not put my fingers in my ears, and I couldn't do it. And that's just with the V8s. So the V10s and V12s are even louder. So I can't even imagine maybe that's a bit of a dinosaur thing and we need to kind of leave the V12 certainly in the past, but certainly the sound, just certain from the broadcasting, the sound those V10s make is just, it's just amazing.
It was the fact that you were getting neat sound. I mean, the exhausts weren't going through, you know, turbines and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure that standing on a hangar straight is a good move, Tom. I mean, the cars are going past at about 330 kilometres an hour. You only see them for about half a second.
Oh, yes. This is why we're just walking around the track during one of the practice sessions. So I always like to do that. Watch. It was always my target to watch a practice session from every grandstand at some point during the day. Watch part of it, and just because you could obviously get free. I recommend doing free roaming on practice days to anyone to go and see a Grand Prix. Even if you can't go and see the race, go to the practice sessions, watch the race from the grandstands, because if you can't afford grandstand tickets, it's a great way to watch the cars going around from the grandstands. Go around, watch from every stand, you get to see the track in such a different light, and next time you watch it on TV, you'll appreciate just how fast they're going when you see the stands.
Chalk and cheese, isn't it? I mean, I'd recommend anyone to actually go to them. It's a bit expensive.
Yes,
it's a different thing from watching it on TV. I mean, TV is pretty damn good. They're much better than they were.
Yes, but definitely.
I say, if you go there, you realise just how fast these things are going.
I've been lucky enough to have gone to three different Grand Prix circuits, and I know I'm in a bit of an elite club there, so I'm very happy that I've been very fortunate to have a very generous mother who paid for me to go to Australia for my 30th, and for me to go to Canada a few years later. So that, and then as many trips to Silverstone as I can muster is all I can really stretch to. But yeah, I fully recommend anyone to go to these races. It's just completely different, even if these V6 engines aren't quite as knock you off your feet powerful as they were in yesteryear. But yeah, I agree, it would be nice to have a bit of a return to the trumpet style exhaust, you know, have a bit more power to them, certainly from an audible sense of view on the new regulations. But I mean, do you think, looking at the way that Formula One is run at the moment, do you think that it is fair the way that the regulations are done and the way that they basically take away the toys and they just ban everything whenever someone innovates something?
Yeah, you've got to have regulation. We were talking about safety earlier on and so on and so forth. I'd also sort of level playing field. And also there's a whole business of the cost cap now to try and make it the playing field more level. I think the problem I have as a fan rather than an insider is it's all a bit too much, you know, that it's all a bit bitty. There are just too many regulations. Why can't you leave this up to the team? You know, they can have and if that works, somebody else might do something similar or try and fail, which is, I think, what Mercedes did with ground effect this year so far. I don't think they'll fail for long, but I'm not really in a position to criticise the actual regulations, Tom, but I think it's back to the nanny state thing. And I'm thinking from a perspective of a fan, it's frustrating that something, you know, suddenly everyone appears at Bahrain or Barcelona for testing, and then someone says, oh, he's got a funny thing on his mirror, you know.
It's a great impression of Christian Horner there, I've got to say.
I didn't suggest it was Christian Horner. And I think as a fan, you're not terribly interested in that. You know, what you want to do is see who's quickest and how the cars look and how they get. I mean, that's what I'm on. Even though I'm a lawyer, I'm not into the regulations. It's just a bit boring. And it's more of a mindset thing. I mean, I don't know the guy. People in my firm, Marks & Clark, are they met trade bodies. There's one called, I think it's called the Motorsport Industry Association that people are on. And often the guy who turns up from the FI is Pat Simmons, right, who, of course, used to work with, I think it was Williams or Tolman probably originally, and then Williams. And so he's got a pretty good track record as an innovator, designer, he knows his way around. So I don't know the guy at all, but I'd have thought having someone like him in charge, I think he's fairly recently joined, I would hope that he might be, have an impact on the mindset of avoiding too many nitpicking regulations that just make people cheesed off.
Yeah, and I think Pat works with Ross Braun at the moment, but I believe they're both, now that the new regulation set's coming in, their intention is to step down at the end of this season, which is
a shame. Yeah.
Which is a bit of a shame, because I think they've done a great job in reinvigorating what we see as a spectacle, and it's a great step in the right direction. I don't think it's a finished article yet. It'd be great to see them continue on with this work, but I guess they've probably earned their money now and deserve a rest and deserve to kind of disappear off into the sunset and watch Formula One grow, because they've definitely helped it on that way.
Well, I hope that's right, and I hope if they are succeeded, they're succeeded by people like them who know the importance of innovation, because Formula One doesn't exist in a vacuum. I mean, it is essentially the pinnacle of motoring, not the land speed record, not even Le Mans. You know, I think Formula One is the pinnacle, the engineering pinnacle of it. So if it's too hidebound with regulations, it just becomes tiresome. I mean, the fact of the matter is, of course, it's incredibly popular right now. I'm told that over the weekend at Melbourne, there were 400,000 plus people.
Yeah, over the four days. So it was
it was basically full up, wasn't it? There was no more room.
Virtually, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the same applies up at Silverstone. You know, there's no more space. You know, and plus you've got this Netflix thing, which I personally haven't seen, but I gather it's increased interest, particularly in the States. So, you know, it's a very popular thing at the moment. But I hope they don't kill the goose.
yes. So if you haven't watched Drive to Survive and you're heavily into Formula One, I don't recommend that it's necessarily going to be definitely for you. It's definitely aimed at people who don't know about Formula One, and to sit there, and he does a great, he's an amazing broadcaster, but to sit there and have Will Buxton say to you, if you start on pole, you have 19 drivers behind you, it's not the kind of stuff that you need to hear.
I think I probably guessed that, actually.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, he loves, I know I heard an interview with him recently, he loves the fact that his daughter now sees him as a meme, because that's just everything that he says has become a meme. Yeah, I think Steve Verish once like saying the colour, was it purple is a fruit, I think was one of the memes that went around, because he just seems to say the weirdest things on these things. But
you should get into Private Eye on the Coleman balls, or they used to call it, some garbled things said by commentators.
Exactly. Yeah, he's trying to trying to follow Murray Walker's footsteps with those. But, yeah, no. So, if you are thinking about watching Drive to Survive, Gregor, I wouldn't recommend it for you. I don't think it's probably something that you would enjoy. I tend to watch it because I watch it with the wife. She's not as into Formula One as I am, and she enjoys it in that sense. But I find it quite jarring at times, because they just change things, and it's not a season review. It's a dramatization of Formula One, and I'm not into the drama myself.
I gather Max doesn't like it.
No, Max doesn't like it either. And that's one of the few things we share.
Yeah.
huge respect for Verstappen as a driver, but I disagree with some of the things that he does on track. But there we go. We'll leave that one there. I think I've shown my true where my part of that support lies, as well as a McLaren fan and a British
fan. Is it better to start off driving too fast than driving too slow? I don't know.
Well, yes, that's definitely. I would rather someone was exciting than slow. Definitely. And what I mean is I just disagree with a few things that he does on track. I don't necessarily disagree with him as a driver. And I think he's a nice lad, an incredibly well-adjusted lad, considering what he's been through as a child and his upbringing and everything. So I think he's a phenomenal talent and a worthy world champion, if before anyone at me on Twitter. But
the world champion, but you probably talked about the episode at the end of the year.
One or two times, yeah.
I'll leave that alone.
Yeah, it's probably best we'll treat that one with a 50-foot pole, I think, and leave that one alone. But yeah, so looking ahead then, so looking at Formula One this season, I'd love to just think what you think about what you've seen so far and what you think is going to happen towards the end of the season, because I love getting people's thoughts on who they think is going to be champion and why and all that kind of thing. So I'd love to hear from you about from what you've seen so far, where you think it's going this year.
Oh, gosh. I watched all three races on TV. Unfortunately, I don't get it live. I watched the recorded thing, but still there it is. It's still the same stuff.
Yeah.
I suppose the first reaction I had is one of surprise that things have changed so much since last year. Not surprised that Verstappen's still in the frame, although his car's let him down. Surprise that Mercedes power units seem to have slipped down the order, whereas I think the conventional wisdom last year was that Mercedes had a few horsepower more than everybody else. I don't know whether that's true or not, because they don't tell you. So McLaren, although they came good in the last race, and Aston Martin and Williams with Mercedes engines are really not, they look to be struggling, and I don't know that it could be something to do with the fuel. Actually, they've got a different fuel this year.
Yes, they've got a 10% ethanol fuel.
Yeah, so I mean that's just a guess on my part. That was a surprise because the Mercedes engine was the creme de la creme. Or I shouldn't use the word engine, should I? I should say power unit.
Yeah,
was the creme de la creme. I think Leclerc had to overdrive last year because the car wasn't so good, and it was quite clear that he was pretty good, and so he doesn't have to overdrive this year, so he's driving within himself, sort of like C, and he's pretty good. He's up there with Verstappen, it seems.
He's all right, isn't he? He does okay.
Yeah, he's definitely all right. So prediction, it's only three races. Yeah. And things can change. The one thing that's interesting and quite exciting is Renault or Alpine. I'm actually Alonso, I probably wouldn't go on holiday with him, but I wouldn't want him driving behind me.
He'd bring his own deck chairs.
You've got to admire the guy. I think he's 40.
Yes,
and he had a time off, and he's had the comeback wasn't that great. But I mean, last year when he held Hamilton off, I mean that's proper driving in my book. He was doing a good job for his team. When Ocon won the race, was it Hungary?
It was Hungary, yeah.
And this year, if something hadn't happened in Melbourne, he would have been probably on the second row of the grid, which wasn't bad for a car, which is a bit interesting. So people who were rather poo-pooing the Renault engine probably are wrong, because it seems to, or power unit, it seems to be okay. So that's a kind of surprise that they're up there so far. The big surprise, of course, is Lewis, it's Mercedes.
Yeah.
And business that they just haven't got. I mean, porpoising, it's a nice word, isn't it? Porpoising was known back in the 70s when they first had the years. It's not a new thing. You've got a Venturi there, and the faster you go, the car gets closer to the ground, and then the airflow, it stalls, isn't it? I'm not an aerodynamicist, but it all gets, and that all happens in a split second, and then so you could see it on the pictures from Melbourne, the helmet. They were going like this. It must be awful to drive these things. Yeah. Anyway, for better or for worse, Mercedes did not get it right, and Hamilton effectively said so. But they're a pretty good bunch. I suspect they will get it right. I suppose the sad story is Williams aren't so bad. They got a point in Melbourne, didn't they? Which is nice. And they look good. Of course, I don't know about you, but I've got a tremendous sort of attachment to Williams from back in the old days. You know, it's a different bunch now. To some extent, McLaren the same, actually, even though they're owned by, you know, different people, completely different sort of people as well. So Williams, I think they have tremendous goodwill, don't they, Williams? Everyone is sort of, you know, plucky Williams, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Although once back in the day with Mansell and Sandler around, you know, they won everything. I think the Haas car and the Alfa Romeo, both of which last year were also ran to the man, with obviously the Ferrari engine have got it right, so that they are competitive. Certainly the Haas. Well, actually, they both are. Bottas is doing well, so that's a complete change from last year. The thing that hasn't changed is that Aston Martin are not really, I don't know what's going on there, but they're, and they've got good people and everything, but they haven't really sort of got on top of it.
Yeah.
Things come and go, don't they, Tom? I mean, who's used to say that next, you know, Imola, suddenly Vettel starts, you know, winning something, or, you know, I don't know.
That'd be nice. That would be nice to see it. It'd be nice to see it. I don't hold a lot of hope for that myself, but it'd be nice to see.
You asked me what I thought of the current year, and that's my instant reply. Yeah.
Excellent. So before we finish, I'd love to talk a little bit more about what you came on to speak about as well, which is about your role involving in intellectual property and patents. So, I'd like to just kind of hand over to you now and to talk about that as well, because you've probably got some interesting stories and conversational points around that. So, what impact does intellectual property and patents have in the sport?
Thanks, Tom. Intellectual property as a heading embraces copyright, confidential information, and patents, which are monopoly rights granted if you claim to have made a particular invention that's new.
Right? Yeah.
Patents actually are very interesting, but in motor racing, I don't think there's an awful lot to do with patents. But I think that the reason is that when you apply for a patent, you've got to give quite a lot of detail about your workings. You can't just sort of make a statement. You've got to back it up with a lot of detail. And all that gets published, right? But not for 18 months, right? Mm. But in the motor racing context, 18 months is an age, you know, it's like two seasons, really. So I suspect, although I don't know, that people in Formula One won't be so troubled with applying for patents, because if they did, A, people would know what they're doing in 18 months' time, and B, by that time, it's out of date anyway. So it might not be something that they need to think about, but I don't know. If there was an invention, for example, some new sort of fuel injection nozzle or something that had a wider application than motor racing, then it might be useful. But that sort of thing, it would be developed by the supplier, component supplier, rather than the manufacturer. So we're talking about things that would be generic to cars generally. Motor racing, tricky, you know, the rules change, someone makes a development, someone gets a better one, you know, it's a fast moving zone, so patents may not be a great relevance. I think the greatest relevance really is we call it confidential information or know-how or technology.
Yeah,
and of course there have been cases where that's becoming very important. The Ferrari complained to the FIA about McLaren nicking some of those. This is all very alleged because nothing was proved. But McLaren got fined $100,000 a few years ago.
$100 million, I think it was.
$100 million, and you know, which is a massive amount of money even for these wealthy Formula One types, and because it was found, well, alleged that they'd taken, it's called, was it called Spygate?
Spygate was what it was coined, yeah.
It had to be a gate, didn't it?
Yeah, of course.
It was a gate now, but yep. It was Spygate. And it was, you know, it was quite a big deal. You know, basically, it was allegations of dishonesty, really, of people who had taken, you know, walked out with drawings or presumably things on computer discs or whatever. I think nothing was proved in a strict sense, so I'm not pointing fingers, but certainly it did result in a huge fine. Earlier there was a case involving an American team called UOP Shadow, run by a guy called Don Nichols, against his ex-employees, including Jackie Oliver, who had been a driver, and Alan Rees, who started Arrows. And in fact, it was proved that they walked out with a load of drawings and stuff. to build the Arrows. And in fact, the court granted an injunction which prevented the Arrows car running, you know, quite serious stuff. But that wasn't based on patents. It was based on people taking confidential information, know-how, for their own purposes. So I think there was an aspect of what we call copyright law as well. It was a bit similar sort of area, not monopoly rights as such, but taking information. And I think my feeling is that cars, that Formula One manufacturers, the teams, are quite careful about their intellectual property in terms of confidential information, and very, very keen on people not seeing things they don't want them to see. I think the story was it Red Bull turned up at, I think it was at Barcelona with his car, and everyone said, oh, that's interesting. Had some sort of tweaks and features on it, which everyone thought was nice, and wondering, you know, how it would work. Next time it appeared, it was a different car, because the one they showed at Barcelona, I think, is this right, Tom? It was a fake. Yeah.
It wasn't so much a fake. The one they released in their launch was just a Red Bull liveried show car that was nothing like the car that came out in Barcelona. But then when they turned up to Bahrain, it was a different car again. So
it was intended to mislead people into thinking what was you know, that kind of thing. So yeah. I think people are quite protective about these. Talking of innovation, I can't avoid mentioning. Years and years ago, the Tyrrell six-wheeled car, right, which I think you probably mentioned on previous podcasts, which I don't think it was actually banned, but it wasn't very successful. Just two things occur to me about that is when it first appeared, the Tyrrell team had a cover on the front wheels that made it look as though it was an ordinary car with two front wheels. Then they whipped this thing off, and everyone went, "Wow, it's got four little wheels." And the other thing that occurs to me about that is just a silly story. You know, when you watch the races and someone comes into the pits, you've got this camera on a wire overlooking the, you know, and, you know, 2.2 seconds later, the cars, all four wheels have been changed. Various other things might have happened, I don't know. And off he goes. A six-wheeled Tyrrell? And how long is that going to take? imagine... coming into its little slot, and instead of four wheels, it's six, and mixing up the big ones and the small ones, and so on. So, well, you know, it would, you know, take about a minute.
It'd be interesting to see how they cope with it nowadays. Definitely. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm straying. I mentioned that because of the feature of keeping it quiet, you know, before the announcement, you know, not let people know. And I think there's a lot of that in Formula One. That if you were to walk, I don't go into the pits or paddock anymore. I can't. I'm not allowed. You know, not part of the inside thing. But I imagine it looks as though everything is very high security. You know, if you start putting your head around something and they're going, "Whoa, look at that!" Right? Someone will, you know, grab you and throw you out. Yeah. But that's all to do with the issue of intellectual property being kind of secrets, trade secrets, and know-how rather than actual rights. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the most interesting innovation I've seen in Formula One, and certainly was well hidden as well, was the Brabham BT46B, the fabled fan car. That I think they protected it by putting a dustbin lid over the over the back of the fan, so you can.
I think that's right, but also the Brabham, was it Gordon Murray decided, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
They explained to them, "Oh, it's nothing to do with the ground effect. It's a cooling fan. Right? Yeah. It's a big cooling fan.
51% cooling.
That's right. We've got a flat 12 with Alfa Romeo engine, and it runs very hot. We need a lot of." And of course, that argument fell down as soon as the car was static and someone was sitting in it and really, when they pressed the throttle, the car went boom, down onto.
Yeah, I love the story that Gordon told about that, where he was told that to make sure that 49% was for aerodynamic and 51% was for cooling, to make sure that they fell within the regulations. And absolutely brilliant innovation in that.
Yeah, it won a race, but of course it was banned. And I suppose it might, despite what I was saying earlier on about nitpicking. I think what would have happened if it hadn't been banned, then everyone would decide they'd have to have one. Of course, but Gordon Murray didn't invent this idea. The Chaparral, you heard of the Chaparral? It was a Can-Am car, Jim Hall, which is way back in the 60s. I think the first ground event, he actually had a separate engine.
Oh, wow.
To drive it. I think it was a two-stroke engine. Mm. It was a formula there allowed you to have whatever size you wanted. Not a bad idea. Have whatever size engine you want.
Yeah. That'll be interesting. No, I think with the Brabham car, I don't think it was actually banned. It was voluntarily withdrawn by Bernie Eccleston because it was just going to run away with the championship because it was so fast that Bernie had bigger ideas about taking over Formula One. So he kind of sacked that car based on that. I believe that's... So that one was not actually banned. It was because Gordon Murray was spitting about it because he spent all this time designing it.
Well, he's still around, Gordon Murray. He's a real piece of work. I mean, he's an amazing designer.
Yeah, he designed my favourite ever road car, the McLaren F1.
Absolutely.
My favourite ever road car.
Have you been in one?
I've not been in one.
I went in one. It's got a central driving seat. A friend of mine used to tell McLaren customers how to drive it without... Yeah, it didn't work with Rowan Atkinson or anything. It's central seat and two seat one each side of the thing. And we went to an airfield at Bovingdon in Hertfordshire and did ridiculous speeds and so on. It was amazing. I mean, unreal, the speed of the thing. And we'd gone there in my brother's Morris Minor, up to Bovingdon. On the way back, he already got carried away because he broke the crank.
Yeah, it's always difficult driving after you've been driving a high-performance vehicle straight after.
And we weren't allowed to drive it.
No, but even just being in one is, yeah.
Tiny. I mean, amazing,
Well, what I'd like to do before we go, because we are running a little short of time now, I would like to, obviously you've been around Formula One and motorsport for a long time, even if you're not massively involved now. I would love to finish by asking you who you think is your most impressive driver that you've seen, whether it be through sheer speed or for them as a person or just the most talented driver you come across. Who would you put down as your most impressive driver in Formula One?
It's a question everyone gets asked. I mean, because you're not comparing like with like. You know, the sort of background, the scene changes and the cars are different and the expectations are different and they're all kind of athletes now, whereas before they were just blokes that drove cars, Well, I suppose until Hamilton came along, I wouldn't have much doubt in saying Jimmy Clark because he was an unlikely champion, very quiet sort of chap. Didn't know him too well. I mean, not many people did, actually. He was very quiet. What was interesting about that era, which we don't really see now, is that you could pop Jimmy Clark into anything and he'd win. A Lotus Cortina or a Lotus 30, a rather sort of bulbous sports racing car, or some giant American saloon car, Formula 2, which wasn't a good thing for him. They were very adaptable, in those. The same applied to all line. Graham Hill won Indianapolis and won Le Mans and so on. But Jimmy Clark just seemed to be. He was just a complete and utter total natural, right from the start. But then I think now Lewis Hamilton's on the scene. It's hard to compare the two. I mean, Lewis Hamilton is just awesome. Mm. If you remember watching when races qualifying and, Verstappen's 0.3 faster, Hamilton's really struggling, and Hamilton would go out in seconds to spare and smash the lap record, he he's awesome. And I hope his season comes good. I mean, he really is a piece of work. But they're all, I mean, even though the ones that aren't so good are astonishingly good.
Yes, yeah, I think there's not one person on the grid that any of us mere mortals could compare our driving skill to without a shadow of a doubt. So when we stand here and we criticise, I was fairly critical of Max Verstappen earlier. Yeah, we're nowhere near the ability of these incredible athletes, and it's another reason why we love this sport so much and why we follow it so much. But that's been a really lovely chat, Greg. I've really enjoyed that, and
yeah, well,
I'm, I'm sure our listeners will as well. Thank you very much. We will be back fairly soon with another episode of F1 Grid Talk. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at F1 Chronicle, and you can follow me at Tom Horrocks F1 if you want to follow me as well. Thank you very much, and we will see you soon. Goodbye.